Hey, BA fam, this episode is sponsored by State Farm. Are you a small business owner looking for insurance that fits your needs and budget? Look no further than State Farm. State Farm agents are not just insurance providers, they're also small business owners who live and work right here in your community. They understand the unique challenges of running and protecting a small business. When it comes to small business insurance, State Farm knows what it takes. Create a plan that fits your needs and your budget. State Farm agents are ready to help you choose personalized policies that truly understand your business. Insure your small business with a fellow small business owner. Talk to a State Farm agent today and get started on personalized small business insurance that fits your needs. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Talk to your local agent today. Hey, 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 happy Brown Ambition Wednesday. We are back with another show for you. This is Tiffany's last week of vacation, which means she will be back this week. But once again, I am here with one of my favorite guests returning to the show. Why don't you go ahead and say hey to the listeners?
How you doing? This is Marcus Garrett of Paychecks and Balances.
What? You sound nothing like Sandy Smith.
I should say one half of Paychecks and Balances.
One half, very humble. Well, Marcus obviously is not Sandy Smith, founder of Yes, I Am Cheap, who we teased in last week's show as being this week's co-host. Unfortunately, Sandy had a medical emergency, and she's really taken ill. And we just wanted to wish Sandy, first and foremost, a speedy recovery. We love Sandy. Marcus and I both have known her for a while, and really respect and admire all that she's done, and just wish her, you know, a safe recovery.
Same. Sandy just put me up on game recently and helped me out personally behind the streets in the DM. So I appreciate her and wish her well.
Thanks to you, Marcus, for jumping in. I know it was last minute. I emailed you in a frantic, you know, haze this morning, like, please be on the show. So thank you so much for taking the time.
It's all good. As black actors got to stick together.
Right. So you guys have been in the podcast game about as long as we have. We had both you and your co-host Rich on the show a few months ago, Battle of the Sexes, dun, dun, dun. It was a fun show.
It was a good time.
But I'm excited to get to know you a little bit better. So first of all, to remind you guys, Marcus Garrett, on top of being one of the co-hosts of Paychecks and Balances, which is forever in the roundups of best personal finance podcasts, is also an author, author of the book called Debt Free or Die Trying. Debt is something that Marcus knows a little bit about, having paid off $30,000 worth of, was it just credit card debt?
Mostly credit card debt, but broadly consumer debt. There was a car loan in there with rims, of course, because I have my taste, a flat screen TV for $3,000, and then just generally having a good time.
There's always rims involved when talking about debt.
Exactly.
Well, $30,000 in debt paid off by age 30, right?
That's correct.
So pretty impressive. And he writes all about it in the book, Debt Free or Die Trying. And let's just jump right in and talk about some of the headlines that are happening today.
Cool.
First and foremost, now I just read that T-Mobile, which is a phone company, all of a sudden wants to be a bank. T-Mobile's launching a 4% yield checking account. Have you heard of this?
I haven't heard of this, but I have noticed everyone's rolling out the banks. Like, I think Uber's getting in the game. I think they tried to sell me a credit card. Chase just came out with like Chase Freedom Unlimited, but it ain't unlimited. It's just higher APR. Like the game is getting a little bit weird out there.
Yeah, so like Uber, yeah, Uber has a credit card, and it feels like a lot of companies are wanting to launch these like hybrid checking slash savings accounts where usually you expect to get a high yield on a savings account like an Ally or Capital One 360. Like these online banks have these really high yields on savings, but now there are these, you know, what they call cash management accounts where they want you to put all your money in one pot and they give you that higher yield. And that seems to be what T-Mobile is launching with its new T-Mobile Money account. But like your phone company and your bank, it's kind of weird to me.
Can you run that by me again? Did you say 4%?
4%. Doesn't that get you excited?
I mean, yeah, that does have my with the beard strokes because, and I do not get paid by this company. Citi was trying to lure me with 2.46%. So, I mean, they might need to go back and revisit. So I don't have T-Mobile. I'm not going to drop who I have because I'm not really happy with them right now. So, but Yeah, I'm stroking a beard right now. I'm stroking a beard.
Well, don't stroke your beard for very long. Like, you don't, your beard deserves better. Because here's the thing. When I hear 4%, the first thing I ask is, what do you have to do to get that 4%? Because there is going to be some fine print. So mm-hmm. I checked it out for you guys. Is this offer as sexy as it sounds? You know, the average APY on savings accounts is something like 0.2% right now. You know, so 4% is huge. So the actual fine print is this, okay? It's not, first of all, as exciting as it sounds. One, you have to be in a qualifying T-Mobile wireless plan, which means you got to like ditch your wireless service and switch to T-Mobile, right? Number one, he's just like, they've lost a bunch of people, including me. Two, you've got to register for something they call vaguely perks with your T-Mobile ID. I have no idea what those perks are. But here's the real kicker. You have to have at least $200 in qualifying deposits in your checking account each month. And the 4% is only applicable to the first $3,000 you save once you've hit those first three requirements, right?
So then what happens after the 3,000? Does it go down to the 0.02% that we're all used to? Or these perks sound like scams, is why I'm asking. I'm just getting more information.
It's not a scam because they got the fine print. They covered their bases. It's actually not that bad. It's still 1% APY, but you can get that from any old bank. Like, you don't need to go to T-Mobile's bank to get that. You can go to Ally, Capital One 360, Synchrony. I mean, there's a lot of, we talk all the time about online banks that offer really competitive APYs this day. So my vote, my personal vote is it's a no for me, dog.
Yeah, I feel like that averages out. If you do hit that 3,000, then that's what, within a 1% return from there. If you did that for the next, I don't know how many months that would take the average person, but I just feel like the average of that is going to get you down to 2%. So then you're back to just sticking with your bank and your phone company, assuming you're happy with both.
Exactly. Because I mean, at the end of the day, like, why would, what's in it for this company to be, you know, when banks compete on rates, they usually compete by like a fraction of a percent. So it's like, ooh, I'm going to raise mine 1 basis point. Well, I'm going to raise mine another 0.5 basis point. You know, they don't compete like to a factor of two, like, you know, double what other people are offering, unless there's a bunch of quid pro quos. So you're totally right. When you actually look at the average rate over the, you know, over a year, you're right on track to what you could be earning at like a regular, you know, high yield savings account from an online bank or something like that.
Yeah, it's a pass for me too, dog.
Are you one of those, because Tiffany's always like on the down low, has some big banks in her, you know what I mean? She's not all the high yield account. It's hard to quit your big bank sometimes. So I'm wondering, like, when you choose banks, are you up on like the new online savings, you know, online brokerage, you know, robo everything, or do you still stick with the old guys that have the brand names and the history?
So the other half of the show, Rich Jones, is better at this. And that's his real name. I'm not, you know, making that up nor name dropping. That's actually his government name. He's better at this. I think he has like 8 accounts or something to that effect. I have 2.
Does that make him better? I don't know.
I think it does. More better managing his money. So I have 2. I'm a simple man. I'll go ahead and name drop. So I bank with Chase for the day-to-day direct deposit. And like you said, I'm probably getting like 0.2% return. The thing is, I'm not using it. And it's gotten better. You know, the 2%, it used to be like you couldn't get a high return anywhere. So because interest rates are going up, you can get better returns. And so I have, because of that, started looking with more interest, no pun, like I'm literally interested. And so I have been looking around Ally, things like that. Like I said, that before you told me about T-Mobile, and then I stroked my beard and then I stopped stroking, I was looking at Citi cards. And so I am becoming more interested in it, but I've been putting all my money either in the stock market, and I got in trouble with a financial planner that I was on her show because I don't have an emergency fund. And that makes me like a literal black sheep, I guess, of the personal finance community. But it just hasn't been a priority for me. I got a fairly secure job. I got fairly secure. I've never been laid off pay. I got a significant amount in savings. And I'm saying some of this to make myself feel better. So I have not gone out and explored. And then the other one is a credit union, which I have through my car loan at a 1.9% interest rate. Damn. And I went to them specifically to get that low interest rate.
I love credit unions.
Yeah, those are my 2 accounts right now.
Except for, we all know who's listened to the show, that Georgia Telco Credit Union still has my $50 that I had deposited in college, and I forgot my password 10 years ago, and they're just holding my money, but still steady sending me statements, like on the down low, just sending me statements. The shade is real. Anyway, so talk to me about this no emergency fund thing. I think this is actually a dude thing, because my little brother, I call him little, he's 27 years old. He
came to, you know, he likes, because he knows I'm in personal finance, and so he likes to pretend like he comes to me for advice. What he really comes to me for is to get my advice and then question it. Like when I told him, you know, oh, you know, save your 10% for retirement, but first, you know, contribute to emergency funds. He was like, why would I do that? And he had the same reason as you. My job is stable. You know, he's in a sales, high commission paying job. He gets these big cash bonuses once a quarter. So why, you know, save his little 5% for emergency fund when he knows he's going to get these windfalls down the line? And I was like, "What? You don't have to." And I just hung up the phone. But I'm curious because for me, on the other hand, like I'm a much more I'm just a saver. I get really nervous if my emergency fund gets low. I like to look at the numbers there and feel comfort. I was laid off from my first job, so I feel like that had a big impact on me too, of that sense of nothing is really in your control when you're working from somewhere else. So tell me more.
Well, I guess it's a three-part, and I'll try to hit it quick, and if we need to go in-depth in any of them, just let me know. So the first part is, I think you should save as much as you need to feel secure. And I have always felt secure, so savings hasn't really been a big priority to me lately, like later in my life. And I'll be writing about this on the site. I write every week, typically on Thursdays, about, you know, that's a privilege. I think what you're speaking to is a privilege that I have right now that I worked towards. So when I first came out of college, I made $20,000 a year, thought I was going to make six figures, put the industry on its ear, didn't quite work out that way. And when I finally did get more security, and I was like, okay, a savings account, typically where I would put my emergency fund, wasn't a priority for me. However, I guess this is bucket number two, my priority was investing. And so I started putting more of my money at originally 10%, it got as high as 18%. I'm back around 10% for some other things I'm interested in right now in the stock market, which I funded through a 401k provided by two different employers, but at one current employer. And I don't regret that because I was able to take advantage of all the growth that's been in the stock lately. You know, it was having 18, 20% returns. Apparently, all these returns that millennials will never see again. So I benefited from that. And I have a secure amount of money there. Now, mind you, it's difficult to access. There's all kind of penalties to get to it and things like that. I'm aware of that. But I kind of look at it, and I talked about this on another show, and I won't name drop because I don't know how that works over here. Some people don't like that. But basically what I said was, you should just be conscious about your spending. A lot of people are kind of like zombies going through life, unconsciously spending on whatever feels good, instant gratification. I want this. I want that. I want to live paycheck to paycheck, or I will just get it in my next commission check. Like it sounds like your brother. That's cool. As long as it's a conscious decision, it sounds like that's a choice that he's made. Bucket number three would be, you can also do as I say and not as I do. And I typically tell people, so the average American right now, and I'm sure you've already quoted these stats, cannot afford a $400 emergency. So clearly, it's about 70% can't afford a $400 emergency without using a credit card or borrowing it from a friend, peer, payday loan, which I would definitely never do. So to me, I hear that and I say, well, you need to start at $500. The recommendation is typically $1,000 or 3 to 6 months. But when I say that to people who have $0, I might as well tell them to go out and catch a leprechaun in the streets, because I try to make my advice practical. So conscious decision, bucket number one, if you have a secure job and you have secure pay and you are doing something responsible with your money, typically I recommend 10 to 20%, something responsible. I automate everything because I am not naturally responsible with money. It's kind of humorous to me that I'm in this space. I am not good with money. I'm good with process. I'm an auditor by day. I do that for a job. I've been doing it for 15 years. I put processes in place that make me successful with money.
I see. Then, and you know, like, oh, sorry to interrupt you.
No, I would say then the other two is, and if that doesn't work for you, are you, like you said, I think you're more comfortable having that money available. So to a person like that, I would say, yeah, start with $500 because that'll cover most emergency expenses just by that statistic and study has shown. And then work your way up to 3 to 6 months and then do either what I'm doing or then start looking at greater investment returns. Because as we opened with, 4% returns at T-Mobile, especially on $3,000, isn't going to get you there. I mean, typically inflation is between 1% or 2%. So every year, you need to find something to either, if you want to break even, you need to be making 2% returns. But if you want to make a profit, that's why people start investing in stocks, bonds, and other secure investments. And then you just got to find what's your risk appetite.
Right. And pushing yourself, because I feel like what you're saying right now is the reason why, you know, I'm a recession graduate baby. And I feel like that had a profound impact on a lot of the people. I mean, you're not that much older than I. We're both kind of recession era, you know, came right up, started building wealth in our 20s around the time the recession was going on. And I think that had a profound impact on me and a lot of our peers, to the point where, you know, you read these studies about millennials being afraid to invest in the market because they saw what their families went through and what their parents went through, losing their homes and their 401k investments and all that. But it's really to our detriment, like if you're not getting in the market, because look at people who left the market after the recession, took their money and ran. They actually would, the people who hung in there and stayed in the market have made back what they've lost and then some, and actually came out ahead of people who left the market. And, you know, the market is not a, it's not just what happens in 1 year. It's what happens over a decade or decades. And that's the kind of like, I'm a logical person. Yes, I'm like, I'm risk averse in the sense that like, yes, I want to have my little cash fund so I can see it and touch it. But I also listen to logic, which is the logic of investing in the market and looking at how people who have invested have done over the years to build wealth, and how that really is in this country at this time, the best way to build wealth, you know, for regular people is to get into the market somehow. That logic is what drives me to stay invested. So I have, it just takes me more, it's just, we both get to the same place, but I have to like, you know, really force my brain to get over what my gut and my heart is saying, like, no, like we don't want, you know, we're scared, you know, I gotta like talk myself out of it.
Yeah. And it's interesting you say that. So for context for people listening, I'm 36 and I got a job twice during the recession. So I kind of had a different takeaway from that. And I was saving the whole time.
You're like, sometimes. I'm bulletproof.
Well, I mean, I kind of go through that and I'm like, my greater fear, I took a different takeaway from the recession. My greater fear would be running out of money. So I'd rather take chances now while I'm 30, 35, 36, and I can just work more jobs. Because there was a point where I was working three jobs. I talk about that in the book. So I'm more geared towards, I'll just work harder. I'll find something. I'll work six jobs if that's what's necessary. But I'd rather be financially secure at 67 when I want to chill, kick back with my cigars and whiskey. I'm a Maker's Mark man. I'd rather that 67-year-old Marcus be secure for the sacrifice of 36-year-old Marcus. And so if that means 36-year-old Marcus has to go a few years without an emergency fund so 67-year-old Marcus can chill, that I'm more comfortable with that reality.
And it's not like you're out there racking up debt to the point where, you know, for people who are living paycheck to paycheck and then they have credit cards that they're just making the minimum payments on, but the debt is, you know, astronomical. And then like if in that situation, losing a job really does mean financial ruin because you have no way of keeping up with that, you know, those debt payments any longer. And that's where people get stuck. So as long as you, like you talk about budgeting and again, like being really conscious about your spending so that if something were to happen, it wouldn't be like catastrophic, you know, for your finance and you have time to get another job.
Yes. And I tell people, not everybody. And, you know, this is where it starts to get, you know, you can't make this one size fits all plan for everyone. And I don't. That's actually, I think, what makes the show popular is like, this is our experience. This is our recommendation. Here's our takeaway. Apply where it fits. Walk if it doesn't. And that is that it's not going to work for everyone. But I do believe that you can do it all. Now, mind you, some of that is my experience, but I did it at $20,000 and I do it differently at where I am in my stage of my life. But I just had to automate it. I had to literally cut myself out of the process. So I set up the credit card payments and I will drop this because I still use them. It's bankrate.com/. I always get this confused, //. It's the slash on the bottom row of the keyboard, calculators. And I used their tools to figure out the exact amount of money I had to pay each month to reach my goal. So, for example, at that time, obviously, I had a goal of paying off $30,000 in debt. My current goal right now is to fund my 401k and then figure out what I'm going to do next to $100,000. And I've written about this as well. And the reason I want to do that is because I did the analysis. I used investor.gov for this to see if that $100,000, let's say I never contributed to it again, I want to get there by 40. What would happen? And if it had an average return about 5 to 7, but I used 7%, it would grow to 600,000 on its own, me doing nothing. And so I was like, okay, Marcus, 36-year-old, you need to race, rally, relay, marathon to 100,000 because then you can kind of take your foot off the pedal. And to me,
you mean to have $100,000 saved in your 401k?
Yeah.
I see. Gotcha. Not like $100,000 saved starting from scratch.
Oh, no, no, no. That's my place of security. I'm much more secure. And because I look at that like my 401k. Now, mind you, this is my current employer. I can take a loan against it at a fairly low interest rate. I think last time I looked, it was like 3-4%. And so to me, having that six figures growing in the market, and I use a target date retirement fund, that gives me security. And then I will start to explore other things I can do with money, my money. But I think most people, as I said, I feel like in the questions we get, they're just kind of unconscious with their spending. They're intimidated by it. So they're not making any decisions. So to your point, they're not making anything in a good checking account. They're not making anything at a credit union, not making anything in the stock market. And then they're possibly also spending it all month to month.
Yeah.
And I'm just like that. The no plan is also a plan. It's just the worst one to have.
It's like the self-fulfilling prophecy, you know. I don't have any money. I don't have enough. I don't know enough to save and invest. Well, then you're never going to build that wealth that way. I'm 100% behind. I started automating my retirement fund before I even knew really what it was when I was 24. At my, not my first job, my second job post getting laid off. But I finally got it together and it's almost been 10 years. And I have this, like you mentioned, because I've worked at three different places where I've had a 401k, and at a certain point, I have one of them separate, like in a Vanguard now, where my first two job 401ks I combined there and just kind of left it. And I'm just like, I have $20,000 extra because I didn't do anything, and when I was 24, I did a small thing. But even if you're 34 or 44, like just start. You know, just start and give yourself the time, because 67-year-old starting to save in your retirement fund, you don't have as much time as you did, you know, in your 20s and 30s to bounce back if there are any, you know, downturns and stuff.
Yeah, you said the recipe to success for most people that I've seen is get started and start young, remain consistent, and get out your own way.
100%.
Keep it simple.
I literally have that on my cubicle at work, is keep it simple, stupid. Like, just get out of your own way. But I got to, you know, and I find that I'm planning for a family now. We just bought a house. My risk averseness has gotten more acute. It's a lot easier to say I can take more risk with my money and be like 95% in the stock market with my 401k when I'm like 25. And now in my 30s, I'm wondering, is it time to be more conservative? And I'm having different conversations now. So, it changes with every decade, I feel like.
I agree. Big life change.
We're going to take a quick break. Be right back with Marcus Garrett from Paychecks and Balances. He's going to help me answer some of your questions in our reader mailbag. All right, BA fam, y'all know when it comes to financial advice, you have to trust your source. That's why you listen to Brown Ambition, right? And when I'm looking to upgrade my wallet, I turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds dives into the details to help you find smarter financial products. I've been a longtime fan of NerdWallet. In fact, I almost worked there a couple of times because when it comes to financial experts and writing, they really know how to give you the best reviews of financial products. I honestly wouldn't sign up for a credit card today if I hadn't looked at a review on a site like NerdWallet myself. And honestly, if y'all haven't learned about NerdWallet, you're missing out. And with their help, what could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade? Lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel credit card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet, finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms of each credit card issuer apply. All right, we're back with my guest, Marcus Garrett of Paychecks and Balances, and I am combing the mailbox. Again, you guys can send us your questions at brownambitionpodcast@gmail.com or hit up brownambitionpodcast.com and click the Ask Us Anything tab if you want to send your questions as well. Love hearing from our listeners. Let's see what we got. I love when you guys have some fun aliases and you don't want your real names out there. That's very safe. So first question from listener Simone. I have some thoughts on this. Simone wants to know, is it okay to date in the corporate office, or should we as women focus on climbing the corporate ladder with tunnel vision? Good question, Simone. When it comes to dating in a corporate environment, honestly, keep it on the down low until you are like legit sure if there's a commitment there, because it's not worth the drama to have the rumors swirling at the office. I have seen a lot of people's reputations be tarnished by rumors about relationships happening at the office place. And you also want to like protect yourself, right? I don't know. You also work in corporate America, Marcus. So going to HR when you're, you know, in a committed relationship to tell them about it is important too, so you can protect yourself. You know, let's say this person is your superior or could potentially be your superior one day. You want to have it on the record that there was a relationship in case anything ever goes south.
I agree. I think it's different for each environment, which, you know, I'm sure she would know better than us. Typically, you're right that you do have to report it to HR once you are in a relationship. So I guess my only takeaway would be, I don't think you can limit it because we're at work too much. I read some crazy study. It's like 80% of your total life is actually spent with your coworkers, not your friends and family. Like everyone else tips off, like it's like a bell curve, except for work where it like plateaus, which makes sense because you're there for 40 hours after college. And so what I would look at it more is, okay, is this somebody in a chain of command? So I'm definitely kind of finger wag or no, I guess, a firm no to anybody like either in my chain of command, above or below me. But, you know, if you're on another floor, if you're in another building, you're in another division, you're on another campus, shout out to my technology workers. I mean, hey, you know, hey, it is what it is. We're real world. We're all adults. But I just think it gets messy when it's like you're in the next cubicle.
Oh, no, 100%. And especially if they're like the chain of command is important. So if they're what do you call it? If they're not your superior, your direct report or something.
Yeah.
Or, you know, could one day potentially be reporting to you or vice versa, like you report to them. It can get really messy. And some companies forbid it. I believe True. There's some rules around, you know, not being able to date someone who's your subordinate or your superior. So you want to definitely check the fine print of your employee contract. I think, honestly, I agree in the fact that, like, if you're in marketing and you really are interested in this person who's, you know, in IT or something like that, that probably isn't a big deal. And a lot of people do meet their significant others in the workplace. But if you're just trying to casually date and there's someone in your immediate, you know, one arm away or in the same floor as you, I think it's just a recipe for awkwardness at the very least, and at the very worst, opportunity for the rumor mill to get going and for you to be even potentially treated differently by your colleagues.
Yeah, I agree.
So date with caution. I actually have never dated anyone at the office. I've just seen what happened when I was in my early 20s, in one of my first jobs, all the inter-office dating. It was too messy for me. I was like, no, thank you, ma'am.
So first of all, I work in a weird industry. So I've never dated anyone at my 9-to-5, if you will, since like age 16. And maybe that was the last time I had to learn my lesson. But I would say it's a weird industry because for us, and I think a lot of people can relate, it's the conferences. So the work is pretty purified and sanctified, but like these conferences are like, you just got to tread carefully, you know.
That's where shit goes down.
Yeah. So it's like the conference getaways. Like I said, that's why it's interesting how each industry has its own culture. Mm-hmm. But, you know, most like there's some rumors that are accurate about auditors, mostly introverts, mostly keep to ourselves. So that's not socializing isn't really one of our strong suits. So it's really not something I've had to deal with, fortunately.
That's funny. Yeah. An auditor's conference is not where I would think there'd be like a lot of romantic entanglements and like excitement. So you're safe. I mean, there.
You got to let your hair down some point.
All right, Simone. I mean, hopefully that was a good answer. Again, just think things through and, you know, focus on your career. But as far as like, I think finding a partner who helps you elevate your professional and personal life, that's the ultimate goal. Like finding someone who lifts you up in your career and in your personal life, that is a recipe for success. So good luck. Let's see. Next question. Ooh, I saw a good one. Where did it go? Ah, here we go. From listener Brianna. Brianna says, first, I love the podcast. Second, I am a recent graduate with a Bachelor's of Science in Psychology. I have plans to continue my education within the next 1 to 2 years, buying a new car, along with moving out of my parents' house. What advice would you give someone like me making about $35,000 a year with about $25,000 of student loan debt? Should I get a financial advisor, or am I just being extra because I don't make that much? That's the question from Brianna. Good question.
I mean, my first response is to pump the brakes. I heard three brake pumps in there. So okay. Because I made those mistakes. So this is one of those, you know, do as I say, not as I did type of thing. Is the new car? Nope. $35,000, especially with new car. So, I mean, the average APR, if it's new, is like $38,000 right now. I saw recently, because I was putting a course together, that $28,000 for a car loan. So that's probably going to eat up all your budget right there. So maybe the first takeaway is to put a budget together with your $35,000, and you'll probably have the takeaway that you can't afford a car. I just did a write-up on this, so I know that if you search Google car calculator, Google actually now has a car calculator, which is both weird and cool, and it'll tell you your exact monthly payments based on your estimated APR, and so you can figure out if that would fit in your budget. And then the other two is I moved out. So at age 22, I was like, I got to get out of here. I need to be free. Let a bird fly. And then immediately went into additionally and more debt, just because in hindsight, I was moderately annoyed with my parents. And thus that takes me to number three. If I had probably stayed home for like 6 to 8 more months, put a financial plan together. So I'll defer to you if you think she needs a financial planner. She can get a cheap one. My answer is going to be yes, or a free one. But if I just stayed home for like 6 to 8 months instead of that 7-year journey to get out of debt, I probably could have had a really focused plan to get out of debt, because 70% of your expenses are going to be food, transportation, and housing, with housing being the largest cost. So I guess to wrap all that up, pump your brakes 3 times, beep, beep, beep. And yeah, I would take some time to reflect over those things. Is it worth going into further debt, especially with that student loan burden that you're coming out with? Or like, is there 6 months where you can at least knock one of those things out?
Listen, I agree with literally every single word that just came out of your face just now. Because first of all, Brianna, you have to go back 2 episodes ago and listen to we dedicated an entire show to auto loan debt, because that is how infuriating I find it that people really put their financial security at jeopardy with these crazy expensive cars. And it's new cars, you know, $30,000 cars with, you know, double digit interest rates, even, because people still don't shop around for auto loans. So I'm not going to go on and on about that. Go check out that episode. But no, I totally agree. You know, pump the brakes. Why not stay home for the next 1 to 2 years? You said you were looking to continue your education. You know, why not spend those next couple of years living at home, rent-free, hopefully? And honestly, $25,000 of student loan debt is not a lot of debt relative to like what the average is and what a lot of people are dealing with. I feel like even on $35,000 a year, if you take the money you'd be saving on the new car note and, you know, the rent for an apartment in your area, and just take that out of your paycheck and put it toward your debt, I bet you could pay that off in a few years, 100%, if you wanted to be aggressive about it. And at the very least, you know, save it in a savings account if you want to give a really good head start for yourself, you know, emergency fund wise, or just saving for a down payment on a house or something. You know, think about the type of investments you can make in your future by taking that time to save.
Yeah, I agree. And I'm going to hit this one more time just in case I didn't say it right the first time. If you Google car loan calculator, that'll bring up Google's calculator. And then if you want to run some of those analyses for the credit card, and you can just put this all and just see. Most people don't even know if they can afford it. What I notice is people go out, buy the car, they get a few months in, they're like, oh, I can't afford this. And so the other one that you could use is bankrate.com/calculators. So between those two, you can literally put your entire budget together. And I mean, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe you can ball out, get you the home. Maybe you live in a low cost of living, get you the home, the car, and the student loans. But I'm pretty confident that these numbers might shock you when you crunch them. So I'd recommend you at least hit those two tools.
No, 100%. But thank you for the question. On the financial advisor front, I do feel like you're being a little bit extra. Like, I don't think you need to worry about that level of advice just yet. The advice for you is simple, is Keep your expenses low. See if you can stay home another 1 to 2 years. Even if you need to leave, you know, get an apartment near mass transit so that you can, you know, stay away from buying that new car, or at least, you know, buy a used car. Don't buy a new car. You know, save money wherever you can. You can get a nice little used car for, you know, $15,000, maybe less, that can be reliable. And financial advisor, somewhere down the line for sure. One of the things that we recommend sometime on the show is the XY Planning Network. That's actually how I found my financial planner, and she was helpful to me. But, you know, if you're just graduating college, the basics is all you need. And if you get stuck, literally Google it. There's so much good content out there that can help you with the first stages post-college, and it's free.
Yeah, I say best of luck, and I hope that wasn't too negative. I'm just trying to, you know, give some advice and some insights from the things I've learned and the mistakes that I've made.
Don't say sorry. I think it's real talk. I mean, this is the advice. The problem is, the reason we're so passionate about it is because you and I probably made the same mistakes or similar mistakes, and you just want to help people from doing the same dumb shit that you did, right?
Like, yeah, well, I don't want to prevent the millennials, or I guess actually she'd be a zennial. I actually don't know what's after me. But, you know, I also want to, you know, the balance of FOMO and YOLO and all the things, which I'm sure kids don't say anymore. But I don't want them to completely miss out. Just maybe go back, hash those three things out, and see if that's really something you afford. I don't think you can. But, you know, if you can prove me wrong, more power to you.
Listen, used car, just take it a step back. A used car. Maybe don't move all the way out of the house. Maybe just rent something nearby. Like, just baby steps and you'll be fine.
Conscious money decisions.
All right. That was fun. Thank you guys for your questions. Again, hit us up, brianambitionpodcast@gmail.com, or go to brianambitionpodcast.com and select Ask Us Anything. All right. Are you ready to close the show with a boost or break?
Cool.
I'm going to make you go first as my guest of honor. Just put you on the spot with your first booster break.
So my boost is also a hashtag plug, and I realized I could drop two, so I'd like to be respectful of the show and hold my plugs for the end. I no longer work for this organization, but I did have a good time with them. So I freelance write for Go Banking Rates, and actually I answered a few of these questions. Y'all can find that at paychecksandbalances.com/GBR. Now you might be wondering where the heck that's going to take you. It's going to route you to my article, so feel free to visit that. That's my boost. But my other one is I'm actually putting a course together that talks about this. And so I'm 6 years removed from the 30s, and now I'm kind of, I read 15 personal finance and investment books, which I read and reviewed, and I'm kind of putting that in a course that I'm putting together. So it's a 4-week debt-free starter course that will be out in National Financial Literacy Month. Our goal is a date to be determined, but we have promised that it'll come out sometime this month in April 2019. But y'all can follow any updates that'll be available at paychecksandbalances.com/debt-free. And my break, I was thinking about this, and I find myself in an existential place lately for several reasons, just being in my mid-30s, a lot of things going on with work. And the post that I'll be writing this week, for those of you making your way over to the website, is just kind of reflecting back on actually all the money I've made, and my cutoff was from college to 36. And so I tried to go out. You can get this from the Social Security, SSA.gov.
Ooh, I love this. Yeah, I love this little PDF they give you with your Social Security benefit statement.
Well, funny you say that, because I ran into a whole bunch of technical difficulties, and basically they were like, I don't think this is your Social Security number. You know, they gave me the fade, they gave me the curve. So it took a whole bunch of work. I got frustrated. I'm easily frustrated.
With the government? No.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they wanted me to send in some extra documents to prove who I was. God. I was like, you know what? I ain't got time for this. So I went out, got all my resumes, looked at all the money that I've made from age 22 to 36. And I basically did a reflective analysis on where the money's gone, where I wish the money has went. And so y'all might find this interesting, especially the reader who just wrote in, who just graduated college, because I graduated at 22. I talk about that. Made $20,000. That has now grown. I did a Yahoo Finance interview about how I grew my income 400%. That's in there. And it's really just a reflective piece on where the money's gone, mistakes I've made. Kind of one takeaway, for example, is that because of the irresponsible choices I made in my 20s, which, you know, I think 20s are wont to do, I delayed financial independence by 10 years very easily. And so if I had just made some of these decisions or different choices that I'm talking about on this particular show and several other shows, I'd probably, it's like, you know, like everybody, I'd be balling out of control. I'd have bought Apple stock. I'd have had a little bit of Walmart stock, you know, boom, 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 Maserati this, you know, nobody. But it didn't quite out. It didn't quite work out that way. And so this piece will kind of walk you through the last 15 years and where I foresee the next 15 years.
And so, where can they find that? Is that on the Paychecks and Balances website?
Yeah, that'll be the most recent post. Excuse me. That'll be the most recent post. So actually, they just go to paychecksandbalances.com. They can see both our podcast and our blog. But if they want to get directly to the blog, it's paychecksandbalances.com/blog.
Look at you guys even writing on the blog post show. You guys make me feel like a lazy podcast host. I'm just like, here's the episode. What more do you want from me? Here's your links to stuff. Dope. I'll put a link, obviously, to the show in the show notes. You guys can check out that post. That's a lot, though, man. I've downloaded. If you guys go to ssa.gov and download your Social Security benefit statement, you will literally see from the year you started paying taxes on your paycheck. It won't do under the table babysitting money or, you know, working for your uncle's, you know, company in the summer and getting paid under the table. But any government check that you've gotten or government approved check you've gotten, it'll appear there and it'll show you what you've earned. And it was a big wake up call. The unpacking of like, where did that money go? I don't know if I'm quite ready for that kind of soul searching yet, but that's a good, no, I mean, it's good to reflect and to see what you would have been differently. And then at least celebrate some of the positives, which is that you have any savings at all, which puts you well ahead of the nation, honestly.
Yeah, I don't want to hashtag spoiler, but there was a lot of takeaways, a lot of lessons learned. And like I said, it put me in a reflective place. I did it for National Financial Literacy Month and really a listener question. So I do presentations out, and I think you might have seen this picture. I think we follow each other on Instagram, but I did a presentation for mentees. And I like to set the bar high. So I was like, the first million's the hardest. You know, that perks them up. You know, they sit up in their seats. You know, I quote Drake and everything like that, try to be relevant. And I can't to this day tell if it was a genuine comment or I got trolled. This person leans on the trolling side. They've been trolling a number of different comments and they're like, man, you ain't got no million. And so I was like, well, actually. And so I went back and did this analysis and just wanted to talk about. And you're right. It's pretty intimidating to see all the tax dollars, I should say, government reported money that has come and gone and that Uncle Sam has got his hands on. So I hope people like it as much as I enjoyed writing it.
Yeah, we'll check that out. Okay, my boost, because we're talking about investing, and we get this question. We've actually gotten a few questions about this, which is how do I, when I'm choosing investments, how do I pick companies that are doing good for the environment or just doing good for the world in general? So there's this movement of socially conscious investing, which is growing. So your robo-advisor tools that are more, you know, more modern, like Betterment, Wealthfront, they tend to have portfolios where you can choose that have these types of investments, and you can choose like eco-conscious, you know, portfolio that has companies that pass certain metrics or certain guidelines for being considered an eco-conscious company, and all kinds of stuff. So what I thought was cool is I just read that S&P 500 is now putting out a social conscious index fund to kind of fall underneath the umbrella of its really popular S&P 500 index fund, which, real quick definition, is index funds are, think of it as taking like a buffet, like going to the buffet, but all the food is different companies and you get to have a little piece of each company versus having to choose just one. And an index fund lets you kind of broadly expose yourself to a bunch of different companies versus a few different companies. And that just balances out your risk. And honestly, again and again, the S&P following these index funds and investing in index funds has proven to often beat people who are like actively choosing individual stocks and stuff like that. So I personally am an index fund investor. I always have been. And like I said, it's been working out fine for me. So I was looking at this and I thought it sounded really interesting. And I have, you know, I have like an IRA on the side where I've invested 100% in an S&P 500 index fund. And I was just thinking, okay, this is easy. Because with this fund, they have done the work, Vanguard's done the work for you and selected companies that they've deemed to fit a certain profile of like a socially conscious company. And I can feel a little bit better. And what that means is like, you may not be, like when you get these, the downside of index funds rather is that, you know, you could be investing in like gun companies, like companies that, you know, don't pay their workers well, companies that are maybe backed by people or politicians that you may not support yourself. And it's kind of hard to see what's actually wrapped up in this big index fund. So when you can actually, you know, choose a fund that has been vetted for you and meets these social conscious parameters, it gives you a little bit of peace of mind, at least for me, to know that I'm investing in companies that are doing some good in the world.
Yeah, for what it's worth, I use a different but index fund as well. So mine's a target date index fund. So yeah, I'm being a proponent as well. And I plan to keep it in there, like I said, until I reach that $100,000 goal. And then to your point, and that's kind of what I was trying to get at earlier, I feel like once you reach whatever your security point is, you can start to make different investment choices, or maybe take greater risk, or maybe more conservative risk, whatever the case may be. But as we said earlier, you got to get started somewhere. And these are safer, not completely risk-free, but safer low-risk investment strategies.
I was just double checking because of what you said about 100K. Between the two 401ks that I have, I'm finally at that 100K mark for my retirement savings. So you're saying I'm going to have 600 grand in a decade?
That's actually exactly what I'm saying.
Okay, I'm just going to stop then. I'm done.
I feel like those are all the appropriate questions to ask, because in some ways you can say it's never enough. But once you've reached whatever your goal may be, which is a personal decision, like you said, is it 55? Is it 67? I read something and I'm a butcher this, but it's like some analysis where they were saying the difference between retiring at 67 and 72, it could be hundreds of dollars a month on how much you need to get as a return, because you're not depending on those funds for a longer period of time in retirement. Whereas if you're going to try to reach, let's say, FIRE, financial independence, retire early, and most of those people are striving for 30 or 40, those people are living on like 50% or 40% of their income in the present, so they can, you know, fund a retirement for 60, 70 years. Whereas if you just have to fund a retirement for 10, 20 years, that's a completely different math, a different analysis, a different funding goal. But like I said, most people just aren't even asking those questions, let alone answering them.
I have my skepticism about those FIRE people, but we can get to that in another show. And just a quick correction. So it's S&P Dow Jones Indices. I think I said Vanguard before, but that's where the new, it's an environmental, social, and governance version of the S&P 500 index. So I'll put a link to that CNBC story. And again, Marcus and I are lovely people with backgrounds, you know, obviously in personal finance, but what are not we? Wait, that doesn't make sense. What are we not? Investment advisors or financial ed planners. So if you guys, you know, want to take our advice, that's fine. But just remember, talking to us is like talking to your brother, or your sister, you know, take it with a grain of salt. And of course, consult a personal finance expert or financial planner if you want advice that's really applicable to your day-to-day finances.
Agreed.
Don't come for us. In other words. All right, this was so much fun. Thank you for making this happen, Marcus. Couldn't have done the show without you today.
Of course. Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, and again to Sandy, feel better soon. We're thinking of you.
Please do. Get well soon.
And next week, Tiffany is back. We'll be back with a regular scheduled programming with my co-host with the most, Tiffany Alice. So we'll see you guys next week.
Mike Carruthers shares little pieces of intel and interviews you can use to improve your life on the Something You Should Know podcast.
The next time you're looking for a job and have to write a cover letter, here's some advice from Skip Freeman, author of a book called Headhunter's Hiring Secrets. Add a P.S. to the bottom of that cover letter. That can actually increase the chances of that letter being read by up to 75%. Some people actually glance down and read the P.S. first.
Something You Should Know. Search on YouTube or wherever you listen.